As the trial of Chad and Lori Daybell nears closer, specifically Lori in the coming weeks, we're trying to give you as much context on the case as possible. So we're going back into the archives all the way to 2020, August 3rd and 4th, for the preliminary hearing of Chad Daybell, parts 1 through 13. So you can hear where it all begins in the courtroom and where it will pick up as the trial of Lori Daybell begins very soon. This is that hearing. Let's go to the courtroom.
All right. Thank you. Please be seated. We'll be back on the record. The court just returned back from lunch. The state had finished their direct examination of Special Agent Daniels. We're moving on to cross. Is that correct, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Special Agent Daniels, if you want to come forward again, you can have a seat at the witness table. You're still under oath. You can remove your mask once you get there. Mr. Pryor, you may inquire when you're ready.
I guess I want a clarification as to how I address you. Is it as special agent or is it as agent, or how would you prefer that I address you, sir?
Agent is fine.
Agent is acceptable to you?
Yes, sir.
All right, I will try to make a point of referring you as Agent Daniels.
Thank you.
Okay. Agent Daniels, can you give me an idea of how many people were at the scene on the June 9th warrant in terms of law enforcement?
We have a crime scene sign-in log, so I would ultimately refer to that to make that assessment. Just to give an estimation, I would estimate we probably had about 50 law enforcement personnel, maybe up to 100 people.
Was anybody at the FBI designated as the person to watch family members and the residents of the home?
I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Were you the chief officer in charge of all operations at that scene at the time?
No, sir, I wasn't.
Okay, who was?
I was the senior team leader responsible for the processing of the crime scene,
okay.
Not of over all operations that day.
Okay. Do you have any idea who was the chief officer in charge of all operations that day?
I guess I probably wouldn't be able to tell you that, no.
Okay. What's an administrative log?
The administrative worksheet or administrative log is the evidence response team paperwork that I, as the team leader, would be responsible for filling out.
And that's something that you maintain in your possession, is that correct?
Yes. Throughout the day, that would be something that I would be filling out.
And
there's a chance that I could have another team member or somebody else fill out that log. It doesn't have to be just me, but that would be my responsibility.
And then the safekeeping of that log would be in your responsibility? Would be your responsibility?
Again, that could be me. I'd be the primary person responsible for that log, but I could designate another team member to fill out that log. For example, that log is also on there's a digital format for that log, which is on a laptop. So if one of my team members was working that laptop, they could be filling out that information on the laptop.
And ultimately, at the conclusion and when the reports are written, that administrative log is something that you refer to and you provided it to the prosecutor, correct?
Yes, at the very end of the day, I would review those logs, and then I would submit that with my report as an attachment to my final report.
Okay, thank you, officer. Thank you, Agent Daniels, I'm sorry. You talked about surveying of the crime scene. There were a number of pictures, a number of photos, a significant number of exhibits, and you described what you called the pet cemetery. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, now, you described that your dig area was approximately a 10 by 10. Is that what you were saying?
Mr. Pryor, I'm having difficulty hearing you again. Can you pull that right in front of you? Thank you.
The crime scene that you described as the pet cemetery, you had noted that there was like a 10 by 10 area. Is that correct?
The area that I described as the pet cemetery, once we were there, my estimation of its size was 10 feet by 10 feet square.
Okay, would it surprise you that that area is almost 20 by 20?
Objection, assumes facts, not in evidence.
I'm not offering facts. I'm asking if it would surprise him whether or not the pet cemetery is twice as large as what he's suggesting.
Overruled.
Would it surprise you to learn that that pet cemetery is over 20 by 20?
I designated my own pet cemetery area, so it wouldn't surprise me if somebody else had their own pet cemetery area. No.
And that's what I guess I want to clarify, officer, and I'm not trying to imply that you're being in any way suggesting anything otherwise. You designated an area that you felt was the pet cemetery based on where you thought they should start excavation, correct?
Correct.
But if you're viewing the pet cemetery from the aerial, it would not surprise you that it was a much larger area where the soil had been overturned. Would you disagree with that?
I didn't assess where the pet cemetery was based on any aerial imagery.
Okay. But did you base the pet cemetery of the 10 by 10 as the actual area that was all dug up and where the ground had been at least disturbed?
So I made my assessment as to where the pet cemetery was based on my visual observation from the ground, and I determined approximate 10 foot by 10 foot area. That was my designation.
And that designation was an area within the ground area that you felt was of potential significance, correct?
Correct.
So in reality, the area, there could be ground that expands beyond what your designation is. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. So in simple terms, the pet cemetery you described could be much smaller than the pet cemetery that's visualized from the air or in reality what the actual size of it really is. Would that be fair?
Yes, somebody else's pet cemetery could be larger.
Okay. So when you designated the pet cemetery and you decided to do the dig, you uncovered two animals, correct?
That's what I observed, yes.
Okay. And the two animals were never identified, is that fair?
I observed the animals to be a dog and a cat.
Okay. And then you mentioned, and you're basing that on your experience of what you think a dog and a cat look like?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, you didn't dig up the entire ground around that area, did you?
Not the entire ground, no.
Right. And you mentioned that there were two or three other areas that could potentially be cemetery areas close proximity to that property, correct?
Close proximities to what property?
To the pet cemetery.
Within what I called the pet cemetery, there were two or three potential graves.
Okay. Did you dig all of those up?
Yes, sir. That area was excavated.
Okay. But within the area outside of the pet cemetery where the ground was still disturbed loose soil was evident, you didn't dig up that entire area, did you?
So the area that I assessed to be visually where I could see what I thought could be graves, that was excavated.
Okay.
With our data, our total station data and our ferro scanning data, okay, we will know what areas we excavated and what areas we didn't.
Okay. And the area that you determined, and that's what's really important about what you're saying, because there's a distinction. The area that you designated as potential graves doesn't necessarily encompass the entire area where the soil in that 20 by 20 is located, is it?
I don't know what 20 by 20 area you're referring to.
Well, I made a representation that is it possible that the area that you explored, known that you're describing as the pet cemetery, you designated how big that area was. But there's a possibility that the area that you're talking about is much bigger than 10 by 10 in terms of the soil that's disturbed in that area. Is that fair?
Objection. He's misstating the witness's testimony.
I'm not misstating anything. I'm asking him, he didn't dig up the entire soiled ground in the area. Is that true?
We did not excavate the entire property. That is true.
Okay.
We excavated the areas that I assessed that I called the Pet Cemetery and the Burial 1 and Burial 2 locations.
So you can't tell me to a certainty that there aren't any raccoons in the general area known as that's marked where that headstone is, correct?
I'm not going to be able to tell you if there are other animals buried on any of the other property besides the locations we excavated.
Right. So in other words, the simple answer is you didn't excavate the entire plat of land that was dug up. You excavated what you thought was designated as potential sites for remains. Is that fair?
That's not correct.
Okay, well, why don't you correct me?
Again, we excavated the Pet Cemetery that I designated. We excavated burial site number 1 that I designated.
Right.
We excavated burial site number 2 that I designated.
Okay.
Those locations, those specific locations, are going to be documented in the data that our FARO scanner documented. Those locations are going to be documented in the total station data that we collected and documented. That information is going to be provided to you. That information is going to be provided to the prosecutor. From that, we'll be able to make demonstrative exhibits, and you're going to be able to know exactly where those locations are that we excavated on this plot of land.
Would it surprise you to learn that I've been out there a number of times, and I observed exactly where you excavated, and it's obviously very clear. Would you disagree that you left an imprint when you did this excavation?
I would not disagree.
Okay. Would you disagree with me that there are grounds and pieces of property that have been disturbed or that are the ground is not solid beyond what you designated as the Pet Cemetery? Would you agree or disagree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at. So based on that, with these extra grounds around what only you decided was what you felt was relevant as far as the Pet Cemetery, there could be raccoons within that, or a raccoon within that property, correct?
There could be raccoons on that property.
Okay. Did you identify any other parcels of the property when you were out at the Daybell residence that also had markings and indications of other pet cemeteries on the property?
I did not.
Okay. Did you look in any other places other than the two sites you chose?
So the rest of that property was searched. We conducted line searches of the entire property. We had 5 cadaver dogs search the entire property. So other searches were conducted of this entire property.
Okay. And did the other searches, other than the cadaver dogs, include looking at places where the ground was also disturbed within the 4 acres that were out there?
We assessed all 3 to 4 acres of this property looking for clandestine graves.
Okay.
And we stopped with our burial site number 1, burial site number 2, and once we discovered the human remains in burial site number 1 and burial site number 2, and we recovered those remains, that was where we stopped.
Okay. So you did not go around, and I'm interested in the phraseology that you use, we assessed. So I'm not really sure what we assessed means. Does it mean you looked at the ground? Does it mean you looked at the adjoining buildings? What does that exactly mean?
Yes, sir. So in order to conduct a line search, we were essentially in a line and we looked at the ground very systematically, very methodically, and we went back and forth across this property, looking at the ground, looking for indications of a clandestine grave, because that's what we're there looking for.
And explain to me what you refer to. You've used that expression a couple times. What do you refer to as clandestine? Please tell me.
So an instance where somebody or persons are trying to hide human remains in a grave.
Okay.
In this case, an outdoor scene, an outdoor grave, similar to burial site 1, where somebody has hidden the remains of a young boy in burial site 1, and then they've placed stones on top of that body.
Right. And I appreciate that.
On top of that body.
Mr. Pryor,
I'm going to object It's going beyond the question I asked. He's embellishing and he's adding to his answer. And quite honestly, I'm going to move the court to strike the remainder of his answer as non-responsive.
Your Honor, he asked the question. The agent answered his question. He can't move to strike that.
Judge, I asked him what the definition of a clandestine, and then he took it upon himself to decide to add all of the other facts about what he calls the pet cemetery and the other site. And quite honestly, it was absolutely unresponsive. What the officer is doing is he's trying to add more and more to the answer, and quite honestly, I'm somewhat frustrated with his method of avoiding answering my question and yet getting in all sorts of additional information. So I'd like this witness directed to answer my questions.
Mr. Pryor, you asked, what do you refer to as clandestine? Please tell me. I listened to the witness's answer. It's clear the witness was describing what he referred to as a clandestine gravesite. I'm not going to strike that from the record.
Okay. Now, you also talked about a fire pit.
Yes, sir.
And in relation to what you described as a pet cemetery, where was the fire pit? Do you have a marker you could mark for me?
Yes. So the fire pit was
just
located.
So the record's clear, which exhibit do we have on the easel there, Mr. Wood?
That's State's Exhibit 10.
Exhibit 10 is being looked at. It's on the easel. The witness is using a laser pointer pursuant to Mr. Pryor's inquisition here.
So June 9th, 2020's fire pit was located in this area.
Okay. What to the closer to you, it looks like there's some brown ground right to the, and I'm not sure of actually the direction that is. Behind the house where you pointed to where you're saying there's a fire pit, why don't you point out where you think the pet cemetery is?
So my pet cemetery that I described, that I assessed and found, was right about there.
Okay. Would it surprise you to learn that the fire pit is at least 15 feet from where you're describing the pet cemetery?
That wouldn't surprise me.
Okay. Were there any indications that there had been any burning in that fire pit?
Yes, sir. There was ash.
Okay, there was ash.
Inside and outside the fire pit area.
Okay. Okay. How deep was burial site number one?
Burial site number one was approximately 1.5 feet. And I'm saying approximates here because I would want to wait until we had the scanner data to show the true measurements.
And the depth of pet cemetery site?
If you're just wanting to know the pet cemetery excavation with the how deep we went with the backhoe?
No, with how deep you went before you recovered the remains.
So the remains, I would say that was burial site number two, and I would estimate that was approximately 2 feet deep. And again, I would want to wait till we had the FARO scanner data to be more precise.
Now, when you talked about burial site number one, you made reference to the fact that you observed a garbage bag, and then you removed the soil around that, and you touched the garbage bag. Is that correct? To sort of identify what was in there, correct?
Correct.
And I would assume that you would be wearing some sort of gloves. Would that be fair?
Correct.
Okay. Who was the anthropologist?
I don't remember her name right off. There is a report that she drafted that is attached to my documentation.
within the pet cemetery.
Mr. Pryor, will you pull that microphone a little closer to you again?
I'm going to do that a million times. It's very difficult.
It's all right. I'll keep reminding you.
Thank you. Within the pet cemetery, I had an opportunity to go over pictures and observe some of this, and I saw no sign of any ash within the soil. Would you agree?
Objection, testimonial.
There's a question to that I'm leading up to, Judge. I think I ought to give some leeway to do that.
Mr. Wood?
He just testified about what he saw.
Okay, I'll rephrase, Judge. There was no ash within the soil of the pet cemetery, was there?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
There was no ash within the pet cemetery within the soil, correct?
I didn't observe that.
Okay, thank you. Judge, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Any redirect, Mr. Wood?
No, Your Honor.
You can be excused from the witness stand, Agent Daniels. Thank you for being here today. May this witness be excused from court today. Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Wood?
Yes.
We'll allow for a moment to clean the witness cubicle. Mr. Wood, who is your next witness?
Judge Spencer Rammel for the state.
Mr. Rammel, who's your next witness?
The state would call Lieutenant Joe Powell.
Did you say Lieutenant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Lieutenant Powell, if you'll please stand here in front of the witness stand, raise your right arm and face the clerk.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give me cause not to give me the truth, the whole truth, and the truth, and the truth, and the truth?
Yes.
Lieutenant Powell, you can be seated there at the witness stand. You can remove your mask. If you'll please point that microphone right at your chin. Make sure that you wait for the question to be answered before or asked before you answer. That'll make sure we're making a clear record. Mr. Rammel, you may inquire when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Can I have you state your name and spell your full name for the record, please?
Joseph Rick Powell.
Where are you employed?
Fremont County Sheriff's Office.
And how long have you been employed at Fremont County Sheriff's Office?
18 years.
And how long in law enforcement overall?
18 years.
And are you post-certified?
Yes.
What are your current duties and responsibilities?
I'm a lieutenant over patrol and detectives.
I'm going to draw your attention to a specific date, January 3rd of 2020. Were you working that day?
Yes, I was.
What was your assignment that day?
Help with the execution of a search warrant at the Daybell residence.
The Daybell residence, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I believe the address is 202 North, 1900 East.
Okay, and that's in Fremont County?
Yes.
Were other agencies involved in the execution of that warrant?
Yes.
Was FBI, ERT team, or ERT on scene?
Yes, there was.
And were you involved in the collection of evidence? Or the initial collection of evidence, I'm sorry?
No, I was not involved in the initial collection.
Who involved, or what agency collected initial evidence on the scene?
I wasn't inside the residence when that was going on.
At the end of the search warrant, or the end of the execution, were any items found in the home turned over to you?
Yes.
By who?
ERT.
And where were you when you received that property?
Inside the residence.
How were those items packaged?
In evidence bags.
What did you do with them?
I hauled them to my vehicle and Detective Mattingly's vehicle.
What did you do next?
We transported them to the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, and I turned it all over to Detective Mattingly to log into evidence.
Were you involved in the logging of evidence at all?
No.
Judge, that's all I have for this witness.
There won't be any questions from the defense, Judge.
Lieutenant Powell, thank you for being here today. You can be excused from the witness stand. Mr. Rammel, are you going to call the next witness, or is Mr. Wood?
I am, Judge.
We'll take just a moment. Who is going to be your next witness, Mr. Rammel?
Judge, the state would next call Detective Bruce Mattingly to the stand.
Okay.
Detective Mattingly, if you'll come forward, stand here in front of the witness stand. Raise your right arm and face the clerk. If you will.
There you go.
You solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony about the human cause of that committee will be the truth, the whole truth,
and
nothing but the
truth. I do.
Thank you.
Detective Mattingly, if you can please sit down there, pull that microphone up to your chin. We're making a record. You can remove your mask once you're seated there. Mr. Ramel, you may inquire when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Can I have you state your name and spell your full name for the record, please?
Brewster Mattingly. Spelling of last is Mattingly.
Where are you employed?
Fremont County Sheriff's Office.
How long have you been employed in that capacity?
I've been employed with Fremont County for 20 years.
And how long in law enforcement overall?
20 years.
And are you post-certified?
Yes.
Quickly tell the court of your current duties and responsibilities.
Current duties as a detective is to investigate felonies and to also help deputies with their other investigations.
I'm going to draw your attention to a specific date, January 3rd of 2020. Were you working that day?
Yes.
What was your assignment?
I was assisting and helping with an execution of a search warrant at 202 North, 1900 East in Fremont County, Idaho.
Whose home does that belong to?
Chad Daybell.
Were there other agencies involved?
There were. Rexburg PD, FBI, and ERT.
Were you involved in the initial search and collection of evidence?
Yes.
Can you explain that further to the court, please?
I helped with the, at the beginning, I helped with the search of the property until I was called to do some other responsibilities on the property.
After the execution of that warrant, did you take possession of items found at that location?
I did.
And can you explain how that came about?
I can. Lieutenant Joe Powell had received a property from the ERT and property log with items. And we took those items, placed them in my vehicle and his vehicle, and transported those to Fremont County Sheriff's Office.
After arriving at Fremont County Sheriff's Office, did you take possession of all items collected at the home?
I did. Lieutenant Powell gave me all the items to book into evidence, and along with the evidence log sheet.
And what did you do after you received all those items?
The next step is to log those items into evidence, and I used the identifiers that were written on the bags or property and logged those into our evidence.
Detective, who has access to your evidence lab at Fremont County Sheriff's Office?
Myself and two other detectives.
On a later date, did you take additional action with the items that you booked into Fremont County evidence on January 3rd of 2020?
I did.
What were those, or what action did you take?
I logged those items out of evidence that had the same identifiers on them from before. I transported them down to Salt Lake City, Utah, to the regional computer forensic lab.
And when did you do that?
That was January 15th of this year, 2020.
Did you take all items that were booked into evidence or just a portion?
I only took a portion.
What portion of items did you take?
That would be the electronics that were listed on the search warrant.
Judge, I'm sorry, he spoke very quickly, and I didn't get exactly what he said.
So Detective Mattingly, if you'll pull that microphone a little closer to you there, we're making a record. I'm having a difficult time as well. Will you repeat your answer to the last question? Mr. Ramel, if you need to re-ask it, please do.
Judge, I'd ask him if he took all items that he had booked in on January 3rd or just a portion of the items, and then asked what items that he took action with on the 15th.
I took a portion of those items. I took the items that were listed on the search warrant that were electronics.
And were there clear indicators on the evidence bags when you booked those on the 3rd?
Yes, there were.
And observed those same markings and same bags when you collected them on the 15th?
That would be correct.
Did you transport them to Salt Lake City by vehicle?
I did.
Did those items ever leave your custody and control during transportation?
They did not.
What did you do after arriving at the regional computer forensic lab?
I took those items to the lab and transferred them to their evidence technician and left them in their custody.
Did you provide them identification?
I did. I gave them I showed them my office-issued law enforcement ID.
Judge, that's all I have for this witness.
Thank you. Any cross-examination, Mr. Pryor?
There won't be any questions, Judge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Detective Mattingly, thank you for being here. If you'll please don your mask again, you can be excused from the witness stand.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Rammel, are you going to be calling the next witness?
Yes, Judge.
Who's that going to be?
Judge, the state would next call Gary Liu.
Can you give me a title? Is there a title to
Judge,
Mr.
Liu.
Mr.
Liu. Appropriate for today.
All right. Mr. Liu, please come forward. Mr. Liu, please stand in front of this plexiglass, raise your right arm, and face the clerk.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give in the cause now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so
help you
God? I do. Thank you.
Mr. Liu, you can have a seat here. Once you've been seated there, you can take off your mask. If you'll pull that microphone up to your chin, we're making a record. Mr. Rammel, you may inquire when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Can I have you state your full name and spell your full name for the record, please?
My name is Gary Liu. Last name is spelled L-Y-U.
Mr. Liu, where are you employed?
I am currently employed with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
And how long have you worked for the FBI?
Just a little over 4 years.
What position do you currently hold with the FBI?
I am a forensic examiner.
Can you explain your educational background and training to the court, please?
Yes. I have 2 undergraduate degrees, one in business, one in information technology. I have multiple IT certifications and one specific to forensic examinations and to smartphone analysis. And I'm also FBI CART certified.
What office are you currently assigned to?
I am at the Intermountain West Regional Computer Forensic Laboratory in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Do you have an acronym for that office or that lab?
Yes, it's IWRCFL. IWRCFL.
Mr. Liu, do you have specific training and certifications of in dealing with forensic examinations?
I do.
Can you explain those to the court, please?
I have a GCFE, which is a certification for forensic examination, and I have a GASF, which is a certification for advanced smartphone forensics. And again, I'm also FBI CART certified.
And as a part of your job and duties in your job, do you commonly examine forensic items such as cellular devices?
I do.
Mr. Liu, can you generally describe how a forensic examiner conducts a typical investigation of electronic devices?
Sure. The forensic examiner usually follows a prescribed set of protocols laid down by the FBI. And these generally include intaking the item from the submitting agency. And once we intake it, we want to ensure that there's proper legal authority accompanying the evidence items. Once we ensure that there's proper legal authority, we assign specific specimen IDs to each submitted item. And then once we give each submitted item a specimen ID, we generate what we call a chain of custody report. And we give a hard copy to the submitting agent, and we keep a digital copy of it at the RCFL, the IWRCFL. And then once we do that, we take the submitted items to a secure evidence control facility at the lab until it is assigned to an examiner. And once the examiner...
I'm going to stop you right there for a second. So until it's assigned to an examiner, is it unusual for more to have one, to have more than one forensic examiner assigned to work on a specific case?
No.
Testify that it's taken into a secure area after that documentation is done. What do you typically do next?
Once the case is assigned to an examiner, he or she can check out the evidence from the evidence control facility into his or her custody. And usually the first thing we do is to document the condition of the items, anything that's unique about it, such as serial numbers, any damage, things like that.
Does the FBI lab you work in have policy and procedure in place to help ensure the integrity of data utilized in forensic examinations?
Yes, we do.
Can you please tell the court about that, those processes?
We use something called a hash value. It's something akin to like a fingerprint for a specific file, something that's very unique. And even if you make a small change to it, it will contaminate the data and you will change the entire hash value. And that's how we verify the integrity, and it has not been intentionally or unintentionally modified.
So something as small as someone adding a comma to data, that would change the hash value?
Yes, very much so.
And do you use a specific hashing tool?
Yes, we do.
And are you trained to use that program?
Yes, I am.
Is that program generally used and accepted within the forensic community?
Yes.
You explained a bit. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions about the lab receiving items or intake from external law enforcement agents. Can you explain the role of an OST in the lab?
An OST stands for Operational Support Technician. This person is in charge of intake, among other things, at the lab.
Within your procedure and policy within the FBI, does the OST typically assign a specimen ID to each item?
Yes.
Is a specimen ID given to one device?
Yes.
Is it ever changed or reused once assigned to a specific device?
No.
And this process of accepting devices from external law enforcement sources, it's documented?
Yes.
Is it, and what is it documented upon?
It is documented in the chain of custody form.
Chain of custody documents common at the regional computer forensic lab?
Yes.
Are they just suggested?
No, it is required.
And are they created in the lab?
Yes, they are.
There on location?
Yes.
Are they kept in the course of regularly conducted activity that goes on there?
Yes.
Are they generated at the exact time when evidence arrives?
Yes.
And that's a regular practice that occurs?
That's correct.
When you specifically are assigned to review a device, does it always have a chain of custody document?
Yes.
And you yourself, as the analyst, has access to that information and enters information on that?
Yes.
Judge, I'm going to have defense provided and then the witness what has been marked as State's Exhibit 30.
Exhibit 30 will be handed to the witness.
Mr. Liu, what is this?
This is a chain of custody form for a specific item.
And how do you know?
Because I see the specimen ID, and I see the case number, and I see my name on it.
Is a chain of custody document that you are currently assigned to work on?
Yes, it is.
Judge, I would move to admit what has been marked as State's Exhibit 30 under Rule 8036, records of a regularly conducted activity.
There won't be an objection, Judge.
Exhibit 30 will be admitted.
Mr. Liu, I'm going to have you take a look, a closer look at that exhibit, what has been marked as Exhibit 30. What is the first entry on that chain?
It is dated January 15th, 2020. It shows Bruce Mattingly from the Fremont County Sheriff's Office dropping off an evidence, and it was received by our OST, Taylor Couch, at the IWRCFL.
And what is the specimen identifier? Do you refer to them as specimen ID, specimen identifier numbers?
Either one will work.
Specimen ID attached with that chain of custody.
It is IWR091201.
And what item does it refer to?
It's an LG cell phone.
And when did you first take possession of that item?
I took possession of it on January 16th, 2020.
And is that reflected on State's Exhibit 30?
It is.
I'm going to hand you, or have the witness, if I could have him handed, what has been marked as State's Exhibit, marked and admitted previously as State's Exhibits 28 and 29.
The witness will be handed Exhibits 28 and 29.
Mr. Liu, I'm going to have you look at those. When you're done looking at them, would you look up at me, please? What is that a picture of?
These two are pictures of an LG cell phone.
And have you seen that phone before?
I have.
And where was that?
When I took possession of it at the RCFL.
Anything particular about that phone in those photos that catches your attention?
Yes, the phone cover is a clear rubber outer case with purple glitters in it. It has hearts in there too.
So safe to assume that you review a lot of cell phones?
I do.
A lot of cell phones that are black or that color?
Yes.
So your testimony that easier to recall this device, or it stands out when there is a phone case such as this attached to a device?
Yes, it does stand out.
What did you do with that device?
After I took it into my custody, I powered it on, attempting to extract the data off the device.
Were you able to extract the data off the device?
I was not.
And why so?
The device was locked. I attempted to unlock it, but my attempts were unsuccessful.
So what did you do next?
I submitted a request to FBI headquarters for their unlocking service.
And did you take steps to have that sent to be unlocked?
Yes, I packaged the phone and I gave the package to our OST to be mailed out to FBI headquarters.
Do you recall the specimen ID on that device?
Yes, it's the same one I provided earlier.
And can you provide it for the court again?
Yes, it's IWR091201.
And when you took steps to have this sent to be unlocked, was it clearly marked with that specimen ID?
It was.
And was it in fact sent?
It was. We have a shipping number for that.
And is that reflected on State's Exhibit 30?
It is.
And where was it shipped?
FBI headquarters.
Did it ever return to your possession?
Yes. On March 12th, it came back.
And is that reflected on State's Exhibit 30?
Yes, it is.
And did you take possession of that device?
I did.
Is it the same device that you identified in State's Exhibit 28 and 29?
It is.
The same device that you had sent off.
That is correct.
And did it contain the same specimen ID?
It did.
Was there anything else added with that when it returned?
Yes, when the phone was returned, I also received a 16 gigabyte SD card containing the extracted data from the phone provided by FBI headquarters.
Was there a hash value generated for that extracted data?
There was.
And what did you do with those items?
I took possession of the extraction and I parsed the data into a forensic tool to generate a report of the extracted data.
Mr. Liu, I'm going to stop you right there for a second. Can you explain what parsing is?
Parsing in this instance is taking computer language, basically ones and zeros, that's not human readable, and we convert it into a human readable form so we can, as humans, read it and understand it.
And do you use a specific program for parsing?
I did.
And are you trained in that program?
I am.
Is that program generally accepted in the forensic community?
Yes.
What did you do with the data after parsing?
After I parsed the data, I generated a report of the entire extraction, and I created a working copy of it and gave it to the case agent.
What is a working copy?
A working copy is a work product that has not been finalized yet that we usually give out to agents who want to see kind of the intermediate steps of what we're working on so they can gather more evidence or look through the products themselves.
And what medium is the working copy provided on?
I believe I put it on an optical disc.
And that optical disc, do you mark it with identifiers?
I did.
What identifiers do you provide?
I marked it as IWR091201 along with the words working copy.
And you provided that disc to the working case agents?
That's correct.
Mr. Liu, we've spoken a little about, was there, before you sent to this item out to case agents, is there another step that you take?
Yes, the last step that I did was that I re-verified the original hash value that was given to me by FBI headquarters. And the two hash values match.
And did you run your own hash value analysis?
Sorry, can you?
I'm sorry, you ran your own hash value analysis.
Yes, I did.
Prior to and, okay, so my question is in terms of the hash value itself, did the pre and post examination of those values match?
Yes, they did.
And what does that tell you?
The hash value, if they match, that means that the data was not tampered with, was not modified in any way, shape, or form. It means that the ending extracted files were the exact same as what the FBI headquarters gave me. There were no changes at all.
So something as small as a comma would have changed that?
Yes.
Them being identical shows that that was not even added?
That's correct. Nothing was changed.
And at that point, you provided the working copies to case agents?
That's correct.
Judge, that's all I have for this witness.
Thank you, Mr. Rammel. Cross-examination, Mr. Pryor.
Sir, what is the name of the parsing program that you use?
It's called Physical Analyzer.
Nothing further, Judge.
Thank you. Any redirect, Mr. Rammel?
Not based on that, Judge.
All right. You can be excused, Mr. Liu. Thank you for being here. Were the exhibits handed to the bailiff? Thank you. Mr. Rammel, is it your next witness or Mr. Woods?
It is my next witness, Your Honor.
And who is that going to be?
Judge Benjamin Dean.
Benjamin D.
Yep, for today's purposes, title of Mr. Dean.
Mr. Dean or D?
D as in dog, Dean.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dean, if you'll please stand here in front of the witness thing up a little closer, raise your right arm, face the clerk.
You solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give in the cause not to be the truth only and the truth only.
Yes.
Mr. Dean, you can have a seat here at the witness chair. Once you've been seated there, you may remove your mask. Please pull that microphone and aim it at your chin. And speak directly into that microphone as we're making a recording. Mr. Ramley, you may inquire when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Can you please state your name and spell your full name for the record?
Benjamin Dean. Last name is D-E-A-N.
Where are you employed?
Federal Bureau of Investigation.
And how long have you worked for the FBI?
For approximately 6 years.
What position do you currently hold with the FBI?
I'm an intelligence analyst.
Can you briefly describe your educational and professional background?
So when I joined the Bureau, I had a bachelor's degree in foreign area studies, and my first position was with the language services section at FBI headquarters. And my job there was to review electronic communications, lawfully obtained electronic communications of FBI subjects throughout the field, across the country. After that position, I became an intelligence analyst. I attended the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, where I received training in topics related to my job. And I continue to do trainings on the web, web-based trainings at work, and also in-person trainings.
What office are you currently assigned to?
I'm currently assigned to the Salt Lake City Division.
Mr. Dean, what are your day-to-day responsibilities?
So I'm an analyst. As an analyst in the field, I'm embedded on an investigative squad, so I support active cases, but my main job is to analyze information and make assessments about specific threats. So some of my duties day-to-day include reviewing information that's collected by special agents, looking through that information for trends and patterns, making and then writing reports and giving briefings with my findings and recommendations.
Do you have any specific training or experience or specific training related to reviewing electronic devices?
I do.
Can you explain, or excuse me, so training or experience, can you explain that to the court, please?
Yes. So as I mentioned before, my position in language services gave me the opportunity to gain daily experience reviewing, interpreting, and reporting on electronic communications for various subjects who were part of investigations, who were under investigation for a variety of threats and violations. After that position, of course, I went to the FBI Academy, and I was trained. One of the topics and subject matter that they trained us on was digital evidence collection and exploitation, and also the use of software for telephone analysis. So I continue to keep my skills and knowledge current in those areas.
Are you involved in the investigation into Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow Daybell?
Yes.
When did your involvement in that investigation begin?
It began in late March of this year, 2020.
What was your first assignment your assignment that you were initially given in March of this year?
My first assignment for this investigation was to review tips that were submitted to the FBI's Office of Public Affairs website. Those tips were submitted pursuant to a press release that was issued on the 5th of March this year, 2020, by the FBI and the Rexburg Police Department regarding the disappearance of Tylee Ryan and J.J. Vallow, who were missing at the time. And the press release noted that both children had been seen at Yellowstone National Park on the 8th of September, 2019. And uh, it it requested that anyone who was present at the park that day, who visited the park that day, who had photos or videos to send them in case they might be of use to the investigation.
Have you received other assignments in your involvement in this investigation?
Yes.
And what were they?
I was assigned to assist with the review of devices, electronic storage devices seized from the property of Chad Daybell on the 3rd of January this year. My first two devices that I reviewed were a hard drive and a thumb drive.
And when did you complete your review of those initial devices?
I completed those devices in late May of this year.
Were you asked to review data from any other devices after you had completed those initial initial reports that you had generated?
Yes, I was.
What was the additional devices that you were asked to review?
I was asked to review two Blu-ray discs containing data that was pulled from devices seized from Chad Daybell's property on the same date, January 3rd, 2020.
And were these discs labeled?
They were. They were labeled with unique FBI specimen numbers. The first disc was labeled IWR091201, and the second disc was labeled IWR091202. And both discs also had the words "working copy" written on them.
Which disc did you begin reviewing first?
I first began reviewing IWR091201.
And when did you begin your review of the disc labeled IWR091201?
I began the review on the 26th of May, 2020.
What was the process you used to begin that review?
I used a Blu-ray reader to open up the disc, the contents of the disc, on my FBI-issued laptop computer. I saw that the main file on the disc was labeled IWR091201. I began looking through the contents of that file and located a subfolder that had several items in it. One of the items was an application file titled CellBrightReader.exe, and the other one was a UFDR file with the name IWR091201report.ufdr. I double-clicked the application file to launch CellBrightReader, and from there I opened up the UFDR file to view the contents of that.
Mr. Dean, I'm going to go back for 1 second. You stated that as you opened it, the file disk was named or had a specimen number. That number specifically matched the number on the outside of the disk?
Yes, it did.
Had it not, what would you have done?
I would have contacted the person at the regional RCFL, Regional Computer Forensics Lab, down in Salt Lake City, to find out why there was a discrepancy.
But no discrepancy existed with this disk?
No.
How does data appear in CellBright Reader?
CellBright Reader organizes the content of a device, meaning all of the data items that are found on the device, into categories based on an item's file type. The category names in the CellBright window are on the left in a tree report, and they're arranged in alphabetical order. And when you double-click one of the category names, a new data tab opens up, and you can see all of the items that fit within that belong to that category. So, for example, autofill, calendar items, call log items, contacts, SMS messages, and so forth.
What file types do you typically look at to determine the user of a given device?
I typically look to see if there's a user of a device, a device user listed. I also look, if it's a phone, I look to see what the phone number is that's associated with the device. I look at the content of the communications stored on the device, so text messages, multimedia messages, emails, and then I also look at the images.
Mr. Dean, did you look at those file types for this device, the device we're speaking of, IWR091201?
Yes, I did.
When reviewing those items, did it become apparent what type of device it was?
Yes, it did.
What type of device was it apparent to you to be?
It was a cell phone.
Did it become apparent after reviewing those file types who the user of the device was?
Yes, it did.
And who was that?
It was apparent to me that Tammy Daybell was the user of the cell phone.
Why so?
There's several reasons that it became apparent to me. First off, the device user was listed as Tammy. Second, the phone number listed for the device matched the phone number that we had in other documents obtained in this investigation, which showed Tammy Daybell was associated with that phone number. There were incoming communications, incoming messages on the device addressing Tammy by name. There were outgoing communications from the device user, again, text messages and emails and multimedia messages with the device user introducing herself as Tammy or signing off, for example, on an email as Tammy. There were also communications, messages with group messages, for example, and also call items and also direct messages with members of the Daybell family. And the content of those messages suggested a close family relationship between the device user and the members of the family. By the way, all the members in those group messages that I'm referring to as the Daybell family members were all also had contact names stored in the device. In addition, there were device notifications found on the device for new posts by the Daybell family, by names matching the Daybell family members, onto a Facebook group titled Daybells and MERS. And there were photos that showed Tammy Daybell and other members of her family, including Chad Daybell, and there were photos by herself and also in combination with her family members. And lastly, I noticed that all of the outgoing communications on that device, emails, text messages, phone calls, they all ceased on the evening of October 18th, 2019, which, based on my knowledge of the case, was the day before or the evening before first responders found Tammy Daybell deceased in her residence.
So after that review, very clear, you believe that the device belonged to Tammy Daybell?
Yes.
I'm going to draw your attention to September 9th, 2019. Did Tammy's phone receive any text messages that day?
Yes, it did.
Were there any messages sent to Tammy's phone that day that caught your attention?
Yes, there was.
What was the number, the phone number, from which those messages were sent?
It was 208-690-9374.
Was there a contact name stored on the phone for that number?
There was.
What was the contact name associated with that number?
Chad.
Throughout your review of this device, had you reviewed other messages sent by the contact with the number associated with the contact, say this Chad?
Yes, I had.
Based on your review of those other messages sent by this number, who do you believe that number belonged to?
It was clear to me that number belonged to Tammy Daybell's husband, Chad Guy Daybell.
Why?
Again, there's several reasons for that. First off, the phone number, the ending in 9374, it also matched with the phone number that I was aware of being on documents, other documents collected or obtained in this investigation, and showing Chad Daybell as showing that number was one of the phone numbers used by Chad Daybell. In addition, the contact name in the phone that we're talking about, named Chad, was also part of group messages with members of the Daybell family. The content of the messages between Tammy, the device user, and the contact Chad with this 9374 number suggested that Tammy and this other user were living in the same house. And
I'm going to stop you right there for a second. The content of these messages over a period of days, weeks, months, approximately.
I would say months, if I recall. The earlier text messages stored on the device, most of them began in August of 2019.
Anything in the messages that would suggest that the individuals between these two devices were married?
Yes.
Specifically regarding to affection?
Yes, there were incoming messages on the device, so from the 9374 number to the phone, with statements or phrases of affection such as, I love you, eager to kiss you, can't sleep without you.
I'm going to draw your attention back to the messages received on Tammy's phone on September 9th. I'm going to hand you what I'm going to show the fence and hand you what has been marked as State's Exhibit 31 for admission.
Exhibit 31 is being handed to the witness.
I'm going to have you take a look at that, Mr. Dean. Mr. Dean, what is that?
This is a copy of the messages sent between Chad and Tammy Daybell on September 9th, 2019.
How do you know this?
I know this because I reviewed these exact same messages in this exact same message conversation, while I was doing the review of the device.
Mr. Dean, is it a true and accurate representation of the messages that you reviewed between those two numbers that were sent on September 9th, 2019, starting at 11:53:27.
Yes, it is.
Judge, I would move to admit.
There's no objection, Judge. Thank you.
Exhibit 31 will be admitted. It's now a good time to take a recess. Mr. Randall, how long do you expect the continued questioning of this witness to take?
2-3 minutes. If you push, sir, you don't want
to be accepted.
That's fine. Judge? Judge, 2-3 minutes left if you want to push through.
Let's do that, and then we'll take a recess before we engage in cross-examination if that's going to take place. You may proceed, Mr. Rennell.
Mr. Dean, will you please read, look at Exhibit 31 that has been admitted. Will you please read aloud the messages in this exhibit, including timestamps and contact name?
Yes. 9-9-2019, 11:53:27 a.m. from Chad. Well, I've had an interesting morning. I felt I should burn all the limb debris by the fire pit before it got too soaked by the coming storms. While I did so, I spotted a big raccoon along the fence. I hurried and got my gun, and he was still walking along. I got close enough that one shot did the trick. He is now in our pet cemetery. Fun times. 9-9-2019, 11:56:59 a.m. from Chad. Gonna shower now and then go write for a while at BYU. Love you. 9-9-2019, 2:47:06 p.m. to Chad. Good for you. 9-9-2019, 2:48:20 p.m. from Chad. I'm back home now.
You testified, Mr. Dean, that these messages initially caught your attention.
Yes, they did.
Why?
The first message in particular caught my attention because it was longer and more detailed than any of the other messages between Chad and Tammy that were stored on the device. Most of the messages between Chad and Tammy were relatively short, and they dealt with matters around the house, for example, picking up, whether to pick up food for an animal, the depositing or cashing of checks, and the comings and goings of one or the other, when they would get home, when they would be leaving. It appeared to me to be the first and only message sent from Chad to Tammy, in which Chad was describing and informing Tammy of his day's events in such a lengthy and detailed manner. The other thing that caught my attention was the date. If you recall earlier in my testimony, I mentioned how my first assignment in this case was reviewing the tips that came in pursuant to the press release that was asking for visitors who had been to Yellowstone National Park on the 8th of September 2019 to send in photos and videos that may help in the investigation. And that was because Ty Lee and JJ had been seen at Yellowstone that day. After reviewing hundreds of those photographs and videos, and consulting with the team members on the FBI side who were also involved in this case about the timeline, I was well aware that that date, the 8th of September 2019, was the last day that Tylee Ryan was seen alive. So upon reading this text message in which Chad appears to claim to have started a fire, shot and killed a large animal and buried it on his property, I recognized that it was sent the day after Tylee Ryan was last seen alive, and I became concerned.
What did you do after you reviewed those messages?
I relayed the information to the case agents.
That's all I have for this one.
Thank you. We'll take a brief recess. Why don't we go back on the record at 10 minutes to 3 o'clock, and we'll begin cross-examination at that time.
Okay. You've been listening to the preliminary hearing of Chad Daybell, parts 1 through 13. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any piece of this compelling court testimony as we prepare for the trial of Lori Daybell in the coming weeks. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.